Right, I will offer some reflections on the theme of samadhi, meditative concentration, meditative well-being. It's quite a large topic, actually. So this is just scratching a few surfaces of it. One could spend a lifetime practicing and deepening in. And its place in the tradition and in practice is quite debated, actually. As we know, Buddhism is 2,500 years or so old and has developed in many different ways in its history. And even if we pick one strand of practice, like here we have this insight meditation thing we're doing officially, different teachers have very different views on what samadhi is and what's its place in the in the practice as a whole is. So to take everything I say with a pinch of salt, this is kind of how I see it mostly. And in the tradition, samadhi has a very central place actually in the Buddhist teachings of the first teaching of the Four Noble Truths of. There's suffering, that there's a reason for suffering, which is some sort of grasping, and there's a possibility for all suffering to end. And the fourth so-called noble or ennobling truth of the path of how to practice, what to do if we practice meditation, if we practice the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings and practices. Samadhi is one of the so-called eight folds of the Eightfold Path. Alongside right view and right aspiration, the ethical parts of right speech, right action, right livelihood. And it's one of the so-called the area of meditation practice of right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. And as you can hear, I did not translate it now, because like many of these terms, samadhi as well doesn't really translate well into one certain word, because it carries many connotations that are none of the words in English cover them all nicely. So it's actually nice to be able to use the Pali terms to a degree, because then if we say it's concentration, we actually miss out on a lot of stuff that's connected to it. If we say it's well-being, we miss out on. So to use the Pali word samadhi, actually, as our practice evolves and deepens and matures, the term itself will become more rich and more kind of defined, more describing for ourselves and others what we're actually talking about, maybe. So it's one of the parts of the Eightfold Path of Buddhist practice. If we think of meditation practice, for example, and let's look at the Eightfold Path again, that there's right effort, there's right mindfulness, and there's right samadhi. It's actually quite central. It's right next there to mindfulness. It's right next there to effort. Sometimes in Western Dharma practice, effort and samadhi are not as central as mindfulness, but they're all kind of equal in the texts. And if we would read the early Buddhist text, the Pali Canon, in English probably, not in Pali, we'd find that the Buddha actually talks a lot about samadhi, about concentration. I think, like in one of the collections in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, it's in every third text he goes into, like, you should practice samadhi. This is what it's like. So that's a lot of emphasis from the Buddha's side on this quality, on this aspect of practice. It's always funny giving a talk, for example, samadhi. I chose to start with the tradition, with the texts, because for some of us it's nice to hear the authority from the age-old tomes. Yes, originally the Buddha said samadhi should be practiced, so now I can take it on myself. And for some of us, it's like, yeah, whatever. So, and we can see for ourselves, how do we relate to the so-called original teachings or the early texts or the historical Buddha and what's left of him in this day and age. And whatever our relationship is it's fine. It's possible for us to practice whether we love the canonical texts or not, or the tradition or not. So, what is this samadhi I'm going on about? As I mentioned before, the guided meditation, it's the practice of meditative concentration, of meditative well-being, of meditative sensitivity, of meditative unity of body and mind, a settling, calming quality of practice, where the mind becomes less shaken to any which way, any impulse there might arise, any particular experience that might come into the field of experience. There's a certain stability to it. But at the same time, there's a flexibility to it, a kind of softness of sensitivity, like I mentioned a couple of times. And as the samadhi deepens, as the kind of serene, calm state deepens, it's actually a progress into more and more sensitivity and less of activity. And not only activity in the sense of how much am I thinking. The thinking mind is actually like, it's not so important concerning samadhi practice. Oftentimes, for many practitioners, samadhi is synonymous to less thoughts. But that's not a, in my experience, that's not a skillful way to conceive of samadhi. Skillful meaning that it's not a, it doesn't work so well, if that's how we picture it. So rather it's a deepening into sensitivity and calming. And there might be thoughts going around, appearing and disappearing and analyzing one's own situation and practice and what one is doing. And that's not a problem at all. That's not the kind of the crux of the issue, but rather the settling into the body, allowing it to calm, allowing the mind to become more and more sensitive to how it's actually feeling, what's actually going on, and soothing it, kind of can't come up with the right expression right now. Maybe I'll return to it. Soothing and kind of a leveling of less bumps and less kind of shakes and so on. That's more of an energetic thing and less of a thinking mind thing. And in the texts, usually where the Buddha talks of samadhi, he talks about so-called meditative absorptions or jhanas, which are kind of these deep meditative states of pleasure and happiness and contentment and peace and further mystical experiences. And for some of us, those are actually parts of our daily practice, and that's fine and beautiful and completely something to practice and something to kind of feed and enjoy more and more. But for most of us, that's not the kind of reality of our day-to-day practice, the meditative absorptions as they are described in the tradition. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't benefit from knowing about them and from exploring the kind of so-called the qualities the qualities that are more strongly present in the absorptions. Like I mentioned, the four first absorptions are ones of pleasure, happiness, contentment, and peace. I don't know, for many people, pleasure is not really a thing in their meditation. It's not something I'm gonna get home and do some meditation. It's gonna be a good time, pleasantness and enjoyment. Maybe for some it is, I hope so. But it can be for almost everybody, I believe. And there's certainly a cultural thing that when we're doing meditation practice, we're actually dealing with hard stuff, we're dealing with our suffering, we're dealing with our emotions, we're dealing with our trauma, we're dealing with this and that and that. And that's the point of practice, to kind of clear out the old karma, to clear stuff up, and then after it's done, then we can feel good to a degree. But I don't know if that's certainly not the whole of the practice. It's certainly a part of practice. But just to know, which way am I leaning in my practice? How do I actually perceive what the practice is about when I sit down or do walking meditation or whatever? What's supposed to happen? That's such a central question. It's hard to kind of, do you understand? It's so important. Because the way we picture, the way we see meditation practice actually determines a lot of what happens, of what's possible to happen. It's a very conditioning factor, the way we picture, the way we see meditation practice, the nature of it. And in this talk, just wanting to break out that it's completely okay. It's more than okay. It's a very good idea to meditate for pleasure. It's like the Buddha calls it a blameless pleasure. And he was a guy who was very much into asceticism and kind of letting go of sensuality in all regards, except for the meditative pleasures. It's actually a resource for us in our life to be able to, that whatever we're going through in life, that we know that, okay, actually, when I get a chance to sit down and close my eyes, there's some well-being, some pleasantness, some peace available. It's a skill we can develop. It's there, and it's not taking anything from anybody else. It's not something we need to buy, to consume. It's not anything that runs out as we use it. And that it's not selfish in a harmful way. Actually, when we do this instead of some less skillful diversions of our attention, you can come up with your own, whatever feels like you're hooked up on. That is actually something that replenishes us. And through practicing this meditative well-being, this meditative concentration, settling, calming, becoming more sensitive, that we're more available to others. It's not something that we're just closing ourselves in our meditation hut, staying there until everything is okay outside. Well, not yet. I'll just stay here and beam in my meditative bubble. But rather that it's actually feeding us. It's actually refreshing us. And it's easier to let go in the world when we have enough on the meditation cushion. It can be a real resource in our lives. And for some of us, it might be like, wow, that sounds fantastic, but it sounds like it's very far away from myself. And it might be far away, and it might not be as far away as we think it is. It might be just around the corner. We just don't see it yet because we haven't turned the corner yet. A lot hinges on how we see practice, like I mentioned. And if we change the way of looking, if we change the way we see practice, the practice changes. It's actually here. It's actually available, this niceness, this ease that the practice in its simplicity can offer. And it's something we can deepen in as much as we like. It's available. So oftentimes in the tradition, in the teachings as it's offered in in insight meditation in the Western world. A central role of samadhi, of concentration, of sensitivity, of settling, of calming, is that it actually serves the other other forms, other aims of practice that we're calling, like it's called insight meditation. So to get insights or open to wisdom or develop understanding, it's very useful to have a basis in this samadhi, in this settling, for many reasons actually. Usually what you'd hear is that, yes, we do a bit of samadhi practice, calm the mind, now we're kind of more more aware of what's going on. So we notice things more. We notice how, aha, things are actually impermanent. This is the basic teaching, that first we calm the mind, then we notice that things are impermanent, and then, bada bing, bada boom, we're kind of more wise. And as you can hear, I have a little bit of skepticism concerning this teaching. It's certainly, there's certainly a truth to it, that's an aspect of how practice will go. And it's interesting why would it go that way, and in what other ways would it work, the practice unfolding through samadhi, through skillful ways of seeing impermanence, of seeing that things that we consider ourselves or that we own are not ourselves, that we don't actually own, or the nature of suffering and its dependence on our grasping, our holding on, our unskillful way of looking. So usually what's presented is that a calmer mind notices things more clearly, and the message is delivered more efficiently, that okay, it's better to let go. And this is certainly part of the equation, certainly part of the practice. Personally, what I find more important actually with samadhi and vipassana, or insight practice, is that samadhi makes the mind more supple, more flexible, more kind of muokattava, malleable, exactly, yeah. That it can take different forms, and this might sound a bit abstract, but in a lot of the insight practice, we're actually taking a way of looking, for example, noticing impermanence in our immediate experience, or just seeing things as impermanent, seeing them knowing that they're impermanent. And the mind that has more samadhi is more malleable to take that way of looking more deeply, more kind of, okay, this is actually what I'm entering into. And it's not just an idea, but it's actually in the looking, in the way of looking, in the way of relating to experience. And that kind of boosts or gives more power, more authority to the way of looking we're applying. Especially when it comes, like, seeing impermanence is kind of basic. Like, everybody knows everything is impermanent. That's no news. That's not the great Buddhist teaching of impermanence. Everybody already knew that everything is impermanent. So, but some of the more harder ways of looking, for example, the one of no self, of seeing, okay, this is the body I'm experiencing, and it feels like it's me, it's my body. To take on the view of, okay, now for this practice session, I will see it as not me, not mine. It's a bit more tricky because we're so entrenched in the self view, in the way of seeing something as me or mine, that the samadhi makes the mind more malleable, makes it more easier for it to take a different way of looking, a different shape, and take it kind of take it seriously for the duration of the practice session where you're doing. Likewise, with any meditative approach we would be using, a bit of samadhi or a lot of samadhi will empower it through the malleability, through the kind of taking on a different form. Ones of not self, of impermanence, of allowing, for example. Once again, quite simple, the idea of, okay, I'm just going to allow any experience. Our entrenched way of being is not an allowing way of being. Rather, it's a way of where we're evaluating experience. We're reacting to it. we want some and we don't some want others, and what will it be next, and I hope it's not that, and all of that. And with samadhi, we can kind of go deeper into the allowing, for example, kind of trust that to kind of take the shape of an allowing way of relating to experience, or a practice of a spacious awareness. We're actually connecting just with the sense of awareness, of a wide spacious awareness where experience is unfolding. Likewise, or any practice we're doing. So we could say it's can be a basis, or is a good basis for any meditative exploration. Also sometimes, like I mentioned, anatta, the not self practice, might be unintuitive for the mind, that we're not used to it. It's so alien to us that it takes the malleability for us to kind of find our way into it. But also ones that are not the ones, it doesn't need to go the way we usually imagine. For example, oftentimes people think, okay, I will do some samadhi practice, but first I need to deal with these emotions that are coming up, or I need to deal with this argument I had earlier with my workmate or spouse or whoever. And maybe it could be the other way around, that actually first we practice some of the samadhi. We put aside these issues, we have these, all of these issues, there's a lot of issues usually, and we practice some of the samadhi. We get this settled, somewhat calmer, somewhat sensitive to what's happening, and then we take an issue and bring it back. We're not only practicing to get rid of the issues or put them completely aside, but rather how does it appear now that I'm meeting it with a calm mind, with some settledness? And usually it's a bit different. Maybe not drastically different, but at least a little bit different, because there's not as much reactivity in the mind when the samadhi is a bit stronger. And has been very useful for myself to just drop the troublesome thing, to drop the suffering, the dukkha, into the situation where there's more samadhi present. And it might not be the thing that we'd like to do. Because if there's samadhi, there's some niceness, there's some pleasantness, there's some calm. I just like to, well, it's good to just be here, and let's deal with the issue the next time. But if it's a real issue, we need to deal with them at some point. It can be a fruitful exploration to drop it into samadhi. And of course, it doesn't work only one way. First we do samadhi, and then we do these other things. But also when we practice something else, it oftentimes brings some samadhi as well. It's not black and white, this is samadhi, and this is something else, and this. But it's all kind of mixed up together. And to help us conceive of it, we speak of it we differentiate. And as our practice matures, we can choose which way we are leaning at which moment. That we don't have to decide, okay, now I'm doing 45 minutes of allowing, and I won't allow anything else for myself. Or that now I'm just doing samadhi, or a metta, or whatever. But rather we can, for example, start with some metta, some friendliness, some the practice of goodwill, and practice the goodwill with the phrases or whatever. And at some point notice, there's a pleasant sensation in the field of experience in the body. I might tune into that now, drop the metta, and just go into kind of allowing the sense of niceness, of pleasantness to envelop the body, to feel it, to kind of really go, really allow it to be felt. It's completely fine to do that, to just like bathe in the pleasantness. And then we could decide, no, I'm going back to the metta actually. Or that, now it's kind of dwindling down and there's not a lot left. I'm just going to anatta practice, for example. It's a playground we can kind of fool around as much as we like in a skill of meditation. But as I said, it's a kind of a, it's a knowing that people in this room are in different places on their meditative career, so to speak, that if we're very, very new to practice, it might not be the good idea to start going every which way in a sitting. But also, I don't want to put up unnecessary walls, like you have to practice for 2 years before you start doing such and such. It's rather like if it's an exploration that's alive for us, that's interesting for us, that's more important than doing the way it should be done or something like that. I don't believe in such ways. Okay, we could say this was the introduction to the introduction part of the talk, and now comes the real meat of two topics of three. I will only reveal two now. One is how to practice samadhi, and the other kind of connected is what supports samadhi to deepen, to flourish, to be a rich exploration. So I'll start with the supports. So oftentimes we might practice and we might have an experience which is painful or nice or whatever, and we might end up thinking, evaluating ourselves or our practice depending on how a certain meditation session or a retreat went. It was nice, yeah, I can do it. It was not nice, oh, this is horrible, it's always going to be horrible and I can't do it at all. But usually actually what's more important than what we decided to do at certain moments is the circumstances where we are practicing, inner and outer circumstances. Circumstances in the moment and circumstances in the near past or even longer past. And we can actually, a part of practice is taking care of the circumstances. And when the circumstances are when the conditions are right, then the practice appears in a certain way. So it's conditioned by the circumstances, conditioned by the conditions. It's important, the conditions. Condition the conditions. Just a couple of to throw out a couple of themes that are very useful for samadhi practice. This could be a very long list, actually. I'm just gonna name a couple of things, you know, very shortly. I mentioned the Eightfold Noble Path of practice, the practice path in its completeness. In a sense, actually, the other factors of the path are play into the samadhi, into our meditative settledness, meditative well-being. So the kind of life we lead concerning ethics actually has a very big role in what happens in our meditation, how we take care of ourselves and how we take care of our others, how we take care of our actions, our speech, our livelihood. And that's a theme for another talk. But just to say that it's not separate. It's not two things. When I started practice, I thought it was two things. Yeah. Ethics is for serious people. I just want to get kind of meditative. I want to experience these states. But it's not easy if I don't express care in my life. Traditionally, they in the text and so on. In commentaries, they say that it's important to feel blameless in practice. That we're not setting ourselves up that when we sit down and concentrate, all of the bad things we've done will come and haunt us. Now, I don't think it's that simple. that it's just to feel blameless. That it's just to feel, oh, I've done my part, not in this complex world. In the Buddha's time, they didn't have the refugee crisis or the rise of the far right or the climate change or such things. And I think those are also part of an ethical life in this day and age. But not to go there now. So that's it. Check. And also the other factors, like I mentioned in the beginning, how we perceive, how we see what the practice is about, concerning samadhi and concerning the totality of the path, will be instrumental in what happens on each in and out breath in our meditation. Sounds like a, yeah, that's how I see it. And if your view changes, your view of the practice, of the path, of the samadhi practice changes, you will notice that the change that happens in the meditation as well. Because they are very deeply connected. And likewise with the other factors, with the aspiration, what is this path for? What is this practice for? Is it for myself? Is it for my immediate well-being? Is it for someone else as well? Is it for a deeper, wider cause? What am I doing this for? And all of the any answer you might have, conscious or unconscious, is fine. Everybody's welcome to practice, whether even if it's just to kind of study more effectively and have more time to drink or whatever. But it has an effect on the practice. And very popular or a very sexy thing or a condition is our relation to sensuality outside meditation. And it's not for nothing that the Buddha speaks so highly of renunciation. As I say, the renunciation, sensuality outside meditative experience, we can sense what kind of vibrations might it be waking up in ourselves. Oh no, is he now going to go into to what? Or yeah, renunciation is the way to go. Yes. My teacher actually, I listened to. He has a good talk on renunciation, and a question he throws out is what if renunciation is just as important as mindfulness? What if renunciation is just as important as mindfulness? It's a very juicy question for myself. Like, yeah, it just might be. Something to examine, something to explore in our practice. But I'd say that a degree of renunciation is very useful for meditation practice. Because just the willingness that, okay, here's this sensual thing, whether it's whatever it is. Usually I'd give an example of a chocolate bar or something. But that's I'm tired of those examples. So you have to come up with your own. This sensual thing, our willingness to just not go there, to let it go. Not to say that we always have to let go, that we'd lead the life of a nun or a monk. That's not our lives. We're Western lay people, so we're not living those kind of lives, and I think it would be kind of would not be the right thing to even suggest it here. Of course, someone might be drawn to that, and all the power to them. But but the degree of renunciation is useful because all of those sensual desires will arise in the meditation as well, and are kind of depending on how much skill we have in dropping that, in just letting it go, to pass, is useful in becoming more sensitive to what's happening in a more subtle experience. This is actually a big thing, because, how to say it? Because the mind becomes kind of used to, becomes accustomed, what do you say? Becomes used to a certain kind of level of subtlety or grossness. So if we're always gorging on sensual pleasures in the more gross sensual pleasures, it's much harder for us to tune into a more subtle sense of pleasantness in the body that will actually grow as we find it, as we follow that thread of pleasantness in the body. But if we're always going for the gross sensuality, the gross pleasantness, it's much harder for us to tune into the subtle ones. And there's also an aspect of that. Well, I'm going to say we are, but I'm saying actually I am. But I'm going to say we are. We're looking to exchange candy for gold. So instead of going with the cheap candy, with the short-lasting kind of unhealthy stuff, we're actually wanting to. I'm going to pass on that and look for something more valuable, something finer, something more wonderful even, or certainly more wonderful actually. And it might be that, at least in this point of our practice, it's hard to get both just like that. But we need to pass up on one to get more of the other. So, ethics, view, aspiration, renunciation. Sounds like everything's connected. Two very important ones. I guess I've said each only with each one. It's very important. But these ones are actually perhaps the most important aspects of meditation practice. So, are you ready? Playfulness and kindness. So that there's kindness and there's playfulness. So when we get on the meditation cushion, it's not deadly serious. It's not like, no, it's time to meditate, to look for the ultimate truth in a very serious way. It's not a matter of laughter or funny stuff. It's actually the question of life and death here. I love this approach as well. But usually in our kind of day-to-day meditation, I invite you to be more playful, that it's actually a playground, the meditation. Or, well, that's one way of seeing it, that it's a playground where we can have fun, where we can try out stuff, when we can go as many times down the slide as we like, or stay on the swing. Yoo-hoo! And it's fine. And all kinds of stuff, of course, happens at the playground, as we know. But it's something where we can experiment, where we can have fun. And it's not always fun, but to bring the sense of that we're trying stuff out here, that it's not the end of the world, whatever happens. There's a kind of a relaxed attitude around it. Then when we get into trouble, when we run into all sorts of hindrances and suffering, it's not as bad than it would be if we were dead serious about it through and through. And I think this is kind of related to kindness, that probably the first kind of motivation to even start with meditation practice is from kindness for ourselves and perhaps for others as well. And to keep that kind of a deep thrust in us, to keep that alive, to keep that in mind, that I'm doing this from wanting to benefit myself to wanting to benefit others as an act of kindness, as an act of generosity, as an act of compassion. And when we run into being unkind to ourselves, just being kind to the unkindness as well, oh, here I am kind of berating myself. Here I am kind of being very disappointed with myself. Here I am kind of wanting myself to do it just right, or whatever it is. And just like taking that baby meditator into our arms. It's okay, Sampo. You don't need to be that hard on yourself. You can have yourself, and I can have my any way you like. Playfulness, kindness, friendliness, renunciation, Patience. I'm gonna just go through all the qualities of mine. Patience. As I mentioned earlier, we can see meditation as a skill as well. It's something that we develop, a skill we develop that we become better at slowly, time by time, as time goes by. We learn more. When I do this, this happens. If I relax like this, this comes about. We learn more and more. And it takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of patience. And when everything is very hard in the meditation, when nothing is going as we'd like it to go, if we keep sitting, we're always developing, at least we're developing patience. Even when we're developing none of the kindness, of the playfulness, of whatever else, at least as long as we're sticking with it, we're actually developing patience. So it's not wasted time. Patience is a virtue, they say. And it's required because practice goes in waves. Now it's easy, now it's hard, now it's pleasant, now it's painful. And the waves are not going to stop, these waves, the waves of hindrances, of restlessness, of agitation, of irritability, of desires, of pleasantness, of peace. There's just going to come more and more and more. And it's rather than trying to stop the waves, it's to kind of, you guessed it, learning to surf, to move with the waves, to kind of flex and learn to play with them. Takes a lot of patience. But it's possible that we can expect the waves. So conditions supporting samadhi. There was a lot. And then the second to last part, how to practice samadhi. So you got a taste in the guided meditation of a certain kind of way in with this practice. But there are countless ways of practicing samadhi. So I'll take a little while saying something about that. Oh my. Very short while to say actually how to practice with this. So usually we use the breath. That's the basic. If you go to a Buddhist center, pay attention to the breath. That's the basic thing that we're taught. And the breath is very useful in many ways. But whatever meditation object we're using, the body sensations in a certain area of the body, for example, or in the whole of the body, in this wider field of awareness, or the breath in a certain spot in the body, wherever it might be, or the breath in a wider area. What's most helpful is, well, most, I've said most helpful in each part, so what's one of the most helpful things is to be interested in what's happening. Now that's kind of, usually things are interesting or they're not interesting. And it's kind of a given to us that, oh, that's not so interesting. Oh, that's very interesting. But actually, is the thing interesting in itself? Is it really interesting or not interesting? Like if we've been to retreat, we might notice that it's so interesting. Wow. Look at the light reflecting from it. I could spend hours and hours looking at this table. But when we get to the retreat venue in the first place and we're just eating at the table, it doesn't like draw our attention at all. It wasn't interesting. So which one's the real table? The interesting one or the not interesting one? Which one's the real table? Is it really interesting? It's not interesting or interesting. It's a dependent arising, depending on our way of looking, depending on our way of conceiving of it. And we can play around with this conditioned experience, with this dependent arising, and we can see things as interesting, and we can meet things in a way that actually makes them seem more interesting. And in Finnish, there's a good word, mielenkiintoinen, which it means interesting. And actually, it's mieli, the mind, and kiintoinen, which kind of is like when something is attached to something, in a way. So that's a, it's a lovely, lovely word in Finnish, because it's actually interesting things are something that the mind gets drawn to, that the mind is attached to, or connected to. And that's very, it draws a nice picture of our practice of when something is interesting, it's actually something that the mind is drawn to. And so yeah, it's you can guess that when we're doing a meditation practice of concentration, of keeping the mind in a, with a certain theme, with a certain area or part of our experience, it's very useful. It's very useful. If it's interesting, the mind will go to it, even if we don't want it to. Like some thoughts that appear might be interesting, and the mind is, ah, interesting. But actually, what if the breath in itself is interesting? What if the body sensations are interesting? And it's not simple, of course. It's not just like, okay, I will see it as interesting. Because we have a way of relating to our experience, of to our body, to our breath, that oftentimes they're not that interesting. For example, with the breath, depending on your practice background, it might be that, well, breath is air coming in, filling the belly, and air going out, then the air belly emptying. It's not very interesting. Not if you want to do 40 minutes of it. It's not like the mind is, ah, indeed, now it's coming in again, and now it's going out again. Now it's coming in again. It's like, just like that, it's not enough to kind of keep our attention. And that might be the way we're practicing. It is a very fucking boring thing to watch the breath, and we're just like developing the muscle. And at some point we're going to have a huge muscle here to kind of keep the mind in this boring thing, not flinch to any eye direction. And then we will be master meditators. Yeah, when I say it like that, it sounds crazy enough. So actually, we don't need that much muscles. If you look at this is somewhat ripped, but many of the Buddhas are actually very thin. So you don't need that much of a, that was a silly metaphor, of course, because we're talking the muscles of the mind. Anyway, it's not a question of forcing the mind to something boring. That's not the skillful way. The Buddha was more interested in skill than in strength. There's a role for strength as well, certainly. But what's more important is skill, how to work with the mind, how to befriend the mind, how to kind of cajole the mind, how to direct the attention, how to kind of tweak and tune and lean with the experience in ways that makes it easier for the mind to come into contact, to settle, to find rest in the experience. I'll give a few suggestions, but it's an exploration. It's something to find out for ourselves. Maybe my suggestions are not ones that are kind of soulful for you, ones that are kind of inviting for you, but there's a lot of possibility. So something I kind of alluded or mentioned in the guided meditation is, for example, coming into intimate contact with experience. We don't actually know what's going on, what actually the body feels like, the sensations in their fineness, the kind of richness of subtle bodily experience is there for us to kind of wake up to. It's happening all the time. Most of the time we're just kind of doing other stuff. But there's a kind of this endless forest of beautiful and wonderful and strange stuff happening right here in ourselves, in this body, in this field of experience, waiting for us to find out that it's there. And we can use just the bodily experience, bodily sensations, the tingling, the glow, the pulsation, the kind of whatever comes up, the tightness and the looseness, the softness and the firmness, and all the textures that are available, kind of just touching it intimately and kind of going deep into it, kind of diving into it. These are all kind of words that might evoke something in your practice. It's not actually like that, of course. It's just a metaphor, a poetic metaphor for us to use to kind of find our way in. And we can imagine the bodily experience kind of enveloping us, that it's all around us and it's kind of filling each pore in us, for example. Or we can use the breath in any way we like. Usually we might, I don't know, usually I've been going on about this for years here, you know, on Tuesday night, so maybe it's already common knowledge, but oftentimes it's taught that let the breath be, just sense it. A beautiful way of practice and very useful to know that as well, to be able to just receive the breath, receive the sensations of the breath and become more and more sensitive to what's it like. But we can also adjust the breath to make it deeper, to let it fill our bodies more, to make it more superficial, to make it light, very light, or to make it such that it actually comes in through the skin from everywhere. That's an impression, that's a perception. We can, all perceptions are kind of just perceptions, so we can play around with them. And there's no harm in it. We can imagine the breath coming in through the skin, for example, or coming in through the soles and going out from the top of our heads. Or we can sense that the breath comes in and actually fills the whole of the body. It's kind of filling up like a balloon in each direction. Or we can have it traverse around the body, go in through the back and kind of somehow turn up here and go out from here. We can really play with the perception of the breath. It can be quite interesting, not just like just playing around, but actually the way we perceive it affects how it's sensed, how it actually seems in experience, that it changes. And this is something we might notice already in our first meditation session, that wow, actually things change now that I've kind of settled a bit. So what was the real perception of the breath? Was it the one where, oh, it's just a balloon filling and emptying, it's filling and emptying? Is that the real breath? Do we imagine that if we get really close to the sensations, we get to the actual physical reality of breathing and we can actually feel reality? If there's this kind of a thought, this view in our minds, I suggest we kind of look into it. Can it really even be like that? We sense reality in that way. We actually sense how the air, how the molecules fill the body, fill the lungs, the belly. What's going on there with this kind of view? It's already a mind-made experience of breath, of breathing. We're free to play around with it. We're free to explore. I've been going on for too long already. I imagine some of you are quite tired of this talk. And that's fine, it's been too long already. But just to mention at least two more things before the final thing. One is scope of awareness. So oftentimes we might be taught that, okay, just follow the breath here or here and just like zoom in on it and just keep it there, like in Pali they say ekaggata, one-pointed. That's a good way of practicing. Am I repeating myself? It's a good way of practicing, but do this as well. Ekaggata, or one point in this. But we're also, we can play around with the field of awareness, with the size of the awareness. Where are we? How large is our kind of scope that we're receiving, where we're paying attention to experience? So sometimes it's really good to just open it out, and just like, whatever happens in this large area where the bodily sensations might be felt outside the kind of normal borders where we imagine the body to be, but experientially we might imagine that we might feel that, oh, the body is kind of expanding, it's kind of felt here as well, and we can just take it in. Well, even if the body feels very ordinary, that's just as fine. To have a wide sense of awareness, and sometimes to kind of hone in on a certain sensation. Ah, oh, there's a pleasantness in the hand. Let's kind of go into the sensations in the hand. Kind of just hang out there. Kind of zoom in on this fingernail, the sensations around there. And then at some point, kind of, okay, if I let the whole hand be there, if I let the arm be there, the belly, then kind of just we can move between the zoom on the zoom angle. And another angle is the angle of effort. So how much are we leaning forward in the practice? How much are we trying to do it? How much are we kind of putting energy into doing this practice? And the Buddha actually says that you should put in a lot of energy. It's not just allowing things to be. It's actually, he says that something along the lines of you should practice as if your head or turban was on fire. That you should practice with the same urgency as a man whose head or turban was on fire would try to put out the fire. So that's a degree of urgency and effort that we're not used to in meditation circles. Maybe in some circles. And for most of the time, it's not so useful to put that much of effort. But to understand that the scale of effort is quite large, that we can really go into it, that we can really try as hard as we can, like really be with the breath, really kind of get intimate with the sensations, like, oh, what it's like actually to breathe now. That's fine. It's a good idea to try it out. And at other times, just to kind of, no, I'm not even going to meditate. I'm just going to sit. And whatever happens, happens. Kind of zero effort. And everything in between. And unfortunately, there's not one right kind of, we can't set the dial on four and just cruise on. Because in different moments, it's the requirement of wise effort is different. But just to have the array at our disposal that we can, the playground is open. I'm not going to say more of that. I could say a lot more about effort, but it's another talk now. And the last thing about samadhi is that a Buddhist practice in general, we can say that it's a movement through meditation, through contemplation, through study, through an ethical life, through community, through many things. It's a life that kind of the deep thrust of it is towards an understanding that liberates us. A deep thrust towards liberation through understanding and love and truth. Freedom, love and truth, we could say. I like to say use those three. That's the deep thrust of practice. Whatever takes us in that direction is kosher. And we can, meditatively, we can take different paths and different kind of emphases on what kind of calls us, what's the practice that speaks to us the most. And it's possible that samadhi practice is the main practice in our lives, in our practice lives. Oftentimes it kind of ends up being kind of connected to other practices, but it's possible to practice samadhi to the very end, so to speak. This deepening in meditative well-being, deepening concentration, deepening in different states of consciousness. Because as we let go more in the meditation, as we become more sensitive, as there's more more peace and less hassle in the experience, we notice that okay, this was the way I was participating in the coming about of my experience. This was the way I was kind of involved in it. And now, as I let go of my involvement, as I become less active, my state of concentration becomes more subtle. There's less grossness and there's more subtleness, and it's nice here. I'm free here. There's a liberation here. There's a cessation of suffering, you could say, dukkha nirodha. In these states, and they can become more and more and more fine. Until at some point, no experience appears at all. The, what's it called? Vedana Vijnana Nirodha, cessation of perception and feeling. And we noticed that all of it was dependent on conditions. All of it was made by the mind. All of it was a dependent arising. And it's a kind of thread we can follow as deep as we like with samadhi practice. This kind of this magic the mind does to create experience, to make it such as it is. And as we see, as we move on this scale of less experience, more peace, less peace, more peace, less peace, at some point the kind of the coin drops. Oh, it wasn't what I thought it was. Kind of I was involved in it. The mind was involved in making it such. And that brings the understanding that liberates. Anything, all things are of the same nature, of the same fabricated nature. And it's like it's waking up to the magic show. The Buddha says the consciousness is a magician's trick entire. We've kind of seen behind the curtain. And sometimes when I give this example, people are like, oh, I don't want to see behind the curtain. I want to be entertained by the magic show. But actually, it's like we're no longer fooled by the magic show. And what opens up is much more wonderful, much more magical, actually. And samadhi is one pathway down this exploration, down the rabbit hole, you could say, towards this understanding that liberates. And that's where I'm going to end. Thank you for your patience. If nothing else, you cultivated a lot of patience during this talk. Let's have a break, and then I guess we'll sit still some more. Thanks.